Menders, Episode 13, Promoting Equity in Healthcare Training with Dr. Scott Michael.
And in America, I sometimes think that we say, the image is that we all bootstrap ourselves up, okay? We all bootstrap ourselves up, and this is a meritocracy, and because you have the merit, you have the intelligence and the work ethic, you got yourself on that bullet train, and you got to where you are because of your hard work.
You're listening to Menders with clinical psychologist and leadership consultant, Dr. Nicola DePaul. Each week, get a dose of real-world inspiration from free-thinking leaders, top clinicians, healthcare innovators, and myself. Looking for quick fixes or standard management tools? Try someplace else. Motivated to maximize the resilience and diversity of your team, sustain your momentum as a leader, and transform your healthcare system? Welcome to Menders. Welcome to Menders. Today we have Dr. Scott Michael. You're a clinical psychologist and you're also currently the director of clinical training and education at Lyra Health, which is a healthcare company. And you were formerly a staff psychologist at the Seattle VA for 19 years. And you and I actually worked together for several years. And you provided a lot of consultation to me about evidence-based practice and just being a good clinician and supervisor over the years. So I'm so delighted to have you today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate that, Nicole.
Yeah. So today we're focusing on that clinical and education role that you're filling right now and starting to think about or thinking together about how do we acknowledge inequity in clinical training as it exists currently and how do we start to kind of shift that? And I know that you're doing a lot of work in that area specifically. So that's really what we're going to be focusing on today. But before we get into that, I'd love to have you introduce yourself a little bit more. Just share a little bit about your background and your current role at Lyra Health.
Absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate that. So, you know, I had spent many years in the veterans healthcare system with a large part of my career devoted towards psychotherapy and psychology training. And that really took two different forms, if you will. One was within our psychology training program. So psychology pre-doctoral interns, psychology postdoctoral fellows, and being very involved in psychology training. But at the same time, I was also involved in the larger evidence-based psychotherapy dissemination effort that the VA has really worked to implement in the VA system, where we were working with postgraduate licensed clinicians who've been in the field for a while, and training those individuals in evidence-based psychotherapies that would be helpful for veterans. In my case, I had a particular focus on prolonged exposure for post-traumatic stress disorder. From there, I came over to Lyra about 8 months ago now with a wonderful opportunity to become the Director of Clinical Training and Education, as you mentioned, for Lyra, which is a national company. So I saw it as an opportunity to take the work I was doing, hopefully, to the next level in terms of some more systems level change in terms of implementing training and evidence-based psychotherapy and assessment. And Lyra, I think, is a really innovative company that I've appreciated working with. So a little bit about Lyra, would that be helpful to talk about?
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, Lyra is a mental health benefit. So what happens is larger employers will obtain the Lyra benefit for their employees. And so instead of going to your, say, Blue Cross Blue Shield and downloading a list of potential providers in your area and just cold calling, what happens is that Lyra is your mental health benefit. So you would come to us for evidence-based psychotherapy if you are an employee of one of our customer companies. And what our focus is working to ensure that you, as a client of one of our customer companies, would receive gold standard evidence-based psychotherapy for the particular presenting issue that you're bringing into therapy. We've since expanded to, we have a whole arm which is related to coaching, which is really neat for individuals who are seeking more coaching. These are mental health coaches too, who are all certified. And we're also starting to expand it to psychiatric medications as well. But the real backbone of what Lyra had been doing for many years is psychotherapy. And I think it's a testament to what Lyra wants to do that they wanted to build out the continuing education and training programs for our providers to make sure people are practicing at the highest level of competence, including cultural competence, as we can talk about today.
Thank you so much for providing that framework. And I have to just say that's a really innovative way to provide mental health care. And I mean, one of the things that, I mean, the biggest thing that I've been focused on in this podcast is thinking about how do we take better care of our employees and, you know, ensuring that we have access to good mental health care, even as mental health or medical professionals, is really critical. Mm-hmm. So I myself had the opportunity to seek employee assistance and use my mental health benefit, but it was cold calling and honestly not getting a lot of calls back because people were so full when I was looking for someone. I did find a fabulous therapist. Good. And I'm so grateful, but I just love that idea of having it really be streamlined as we're taking care of our employees.
Yeah, you know, part of what we do is up front, we have what's called our care team. And the care team are live individuals who are working with you. I mean, people will still access initially their benefit through going on online, but then there's a live individual to help work with you to find a provider who we have vetted as being a provider of the best evidence-based psychotherapy. So that's part of the system, because, you know, what we know is many people will slip through the cracks.
Hey, if you're listening to this and you're not sure how to get started to address burnout and create a culture of well-being in your organization, and you're looking for a roadmap and someone to support your team through this process, listen up, because this is for you. Investing in your people is the smartest thing your healthcare system can do. Whether you have a tiny system or a large complex department, there are focused actions you can take to transform your organizational culture from burnout to well-being. I work with leadership teams to simplify and demystify this process so that you can feel really good about the efforts you're putting out in the world and so confident that your investments in employee engagement and team well-being will pay dividends. Head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com and join me today.
You stuck with it, which is really good. Many people won't. They call two people, three people maybe. They don't get callbacks. They get frustrated. They stop right there. And they're not getting the care that they need and deserve.
And as we're thinking about burnout, it's pretty easy to get to lose that persistence or to not continue to follow through. So how, so kind of thinking about promoting equity and training and getting like really diverse set of clinicians involved as treatment providers in that kind of program. What are you thinking about at that level? How do you, I mean, I don't know if you're involved with recruitment directly, but how do you think about creating a system that really does involve diverse providers who can meet the really diverse needs of a changing workforce?
Where I think it starts, and this is something that I would make no claims to being the person who creates this myself, we're all working on this together, is I think it starts in an inclusive workspace. I think that there needs to be a sense of, if we look at our DEIB values, well, the I and the B in there are really critical, the inclusiveness and the belongingness. And I think that what Lyra has been striving to do is creating a diverse workforce. And the more diversity, the more diverse employees you have, the more you get, I think, because there's a sense that this is a place where I could be included. There's a sense that this is a place where I could belong and work in a psychologically safe environment. Because I think psychological safety is absolutely critical in any workplace. If you don't have psychological safety, you're not going to be at your optimal level of performance, you might be looking somewhere else for another job, which makes absolute sense. And I think in mental health care, sometimes we're better at providing the care to people than to taking care of ourselves. And so I appreciate being in a workplace where we're talking about taking care of ourselves. It's one of our core values here at Lyra, which is mind yourself is what it says. And it means to be mindful of yourself, take care of yourself, and to take care of your colleagues as well. You know, provide that space for people to be, to have a sense of psychological safety where it's okay to take a mental health day. It's okay to take a little space for yourself. It makes us all better teammates together. And so I think part of that, too, in answer to your question is there a sense that somebody like me, whoever the me may be, will belong here? And I think that that's where a lot of that starts. And so, you have to start with building it. And as you build it, it builds momentum, right? It's like a snowball rolling downhill. And I think it improves that sense of inclusiveness and belongingness as you can recruit more and more excellent people.
Can you just speak a little bit more about how you do that in really practical ways? Because I hear a lot of lip service about those things.
Right.
Like, let's create belonging or, you know, psychological safety. But I think it's much more challenging to actually do that in a way that kind of walks the walk or demonstrates that it's truly okay to care for your mental health needs. Like, to give an example, I'm involved with training in my institution, and I had a meeting with my set of trainees this morning, and they were talking about, you know, the recent personal challenges that they've been experiencing in the wake of the Uvalde shooting in particular. And I have three trainees of color actually in my current cohort. And, you know, they were expressing some confusion or sadness about not actually having the space to take a mental health day or to have a break from clinical care when they were processing this pretty heavy information and trying to work out their own role and how to respond. So, I mean, how do you really move past the lip service into practically implementing those kinds of strategies?
Well, I think you're right on to something there. There can be a lot of virtue signaling, right? Well, it's listed in our mission statement, and our mission statement is online, and that therefore we are doing it. You have to walk the walk, right? So you got to take further steps than that. And I think providing that listening space, I think that right there to me is can we make that structural? That's very important. In other words, are there places built into your workplace in which there is space for people to come together, to listen, to be heard, to also listen? Is that destigmatized but elevated as a very important part of a healthy workplace? Can we do this here, for instance? We have places where we have things called like intentional conversations, and then we in listening sessions and things of that nature, so that people do have a place. I think that again establishes even greater psychological safety. Hey, it's okay for me here to talk about that stuff. And so that I think is an important piece. You can't just put it on a poster. You got to actually do something about it. And I think providing those listening spaces and then coming up with initiatives. So not only am I being heard, but is my workplace doing something about that?
Yeah. So really having the listening and the follow-up with clear action.
Right. It's been an interesting thing being, in a business environment. I mean, you and I know what it's like to be in a VA environment for a long time, and business environments are very goal-oriented, and things are oftentimes quantified in terms of a goal that you can measure. So, for instance, I don't have the figures at the top of my head, but we have goals of hiring a certain percentage and maintaining a certain percentage of BIPOC clinicians or LGBTQIA+. Clinicians and employees, right? So not everybody who works for Lyra is a clinician. Some are employees who help the clinicians do all the great work they're doing. Do our BIPOC or LGBTQIA+ clients feel like their therapists are being responsive to them and their own identity and intersecting identity. So that's something we're taking a look at. So that's what I mean by actually trying to do something about it. Having something concrete that you can actually put into effect and measure and then try to do better if you're not doing well.
And how do you communicate that or those goals to the clinicians you have?
Well, and that, I think that's where I come in, you know, to an extent, which is where the training and education comes in. You know, are we addressing for our clinicians, are we addressing their needs for helping develop skills and working with people from different cultures, different identities in a culturally competent way? Are we providing useful, not just useful clinical skills. I mean, we need to think about useful assessment and useful psychotherapy training, but also consultation. And that's something we're looking to build out right now is, are there places where clinicians can come to talk about specific cases? So I think about this a lot in education. You know, we can all attend a 1-hour lecture, a 2-hour lecture. How does that actually translate into competencies, right? If you look in mental health care or any of the allied health care training models, there's been a real movement towards competence-based education, a real movement away from imparting knowledge to competency-based. So it's not just the knowledge you accrued, it's what you're doing with it that becomes really critical. Do you actually have a competency to implement those skills you're learning? And so that's something that I've been thinking a lot about in terms of what we can do with training and education. It's very important to impart knowledge to people, and then it's important to provide spaces where they can learn how to better implement it. And that's where consultation comes in. You know, this is in the training and education literature. If you look across, there needs to be some place where you can seek consultation, either amongst peers or with subject matter experts, or both. But a place where you can actually, you know, if you look at some of the work by people like Scott Miller and his colleagues, they talk about deliberative practice. And in deliberative practice, which makes us all better clinicians, do you have a place where you can come talk about particular cases and how to get better?
So I'm curious from a really pragmatic standpoint, how do you build in opportunity for that case consultation when that's not something that clinicians are getting reimbursed for? Like, how do you navigate that, I guess, the productivity, learning, competence, growth, fulfillment dance?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there are several avenues. You know, it is true that everybody is very busy and everybody has to find space for things. I do think that we, by and large, have a group of clinicians who are intrinsically motivated to seek these things out. So, for instance, while people don't get reimbursed to attend the continuing education presentations we put on, there's an intrinsic motivation to seek that out. And I know that because we get really good numbers. We get a lot of people who are taking time out of their schedule to come. There's a little extrinsic motivation because they get a CE certificate, and we all need that for licensure. But I don't think that that's just the only motivation by which people are seeking out these trainings. We've over half of our CE trainings since I've come on board have been related to what we like to call culturally responsive care. So some topic area that's culturally responsive. Pure clinical topics are great. And I think it's really important for us all to learn things. And by pure clinical, I mean, exposure therapy for social anxiety disorder. Super important, right? And, you know, we also need our continuing education focused on elements of culturally responsive care. And over half of ours have been to date since I've been on board. And those are well attended. There's an intrinsic motivation to seek that out, at least I think amongst our group here, which I'm very, I can't say that I'm proud of because I don't have any ownership over that, but I'm excited that people are interested in that.
That's really neat. It sounds like a really committed group of clinicians. And I can certainly speak for myself when I'm attending those kinds of, you know, CE programs or case consultations, you know, it is often the most meaningful part of my day where I get to connect with peers and learn and be intellectually challenged. And I imagine I'm not unique in getting those benefits from those kinds of programs.
Absolutely.
I guess something else I'm curious about. How do you see that this kind of training or those kinds of opportunities as fitting in with creating a more nourishing environment for the clinicians or the employees who are, you know, part of your organization?
You know, I think if I were to reflect on the last few years, and I think that, the last few years have been hard for everybody in many different ways and many different manifestations and many cumulative effects as well. But I think that there can, given what's happening in the nation and given what's happening politically and nationally, when you see something like the murder of George Floyd, right? And there can be a powerlessness we can all feel. I think that many of us are committed to mental health because we want to care for people and take care of people. And there's only so much power that I personally have. And there's political power that we can exercise together. But there's also, in terms of the clinical power, can we address the needs of our clients? And therefore, it's really, I think, in a lot of ways, addressing the needs of ourselves in order to provide the highest quality care. So in other words, if I feel like I'm providing the highest quality psychotherapy to my clients, that is nourishing to me. And if I'm going to provide high quality clinical care, I need to constantly be culturally humble and seeking out new ways of learning. I mean, I really appreciate the term cultural humility rather than cultural competence. Sometimes I struggle with the idea of cultural competence. And the reason I struggle with it at times is that competence almost implies that once you've achieved something, you're there. And I think when it comes to using a term like growth or humility, it's an admission that you're never entirely there. It's always a growing process. And so I think that as we have ways that we can exercise some form of control, it is nourishing to us. If I can help one particular client enact the growth they're looking to enact, to progress in the way that they're wanting to progress, that nourishes me. And so, because we all come from many different cultures and many identities, and we know people from certain marginalized groups and cultures and identities have had more structural impediments in their way, that suggests that I, as a clinician, need to strive even harder to be aware of those things so that I can help facilitate that change.
As I was listening to you talk, one of the things that came up for me was like the moral injury that I think clinicians experience when we're not able to provide that high level of care, or when we do feel incompetent and maybe we have nowhere to send this particular patient, or we don't know who to consult with in order to provide that really high level of care. So I love that idea of self-nourishing through being able to provide, like learn and provide such high quality.
And can I interject one thing there that it makes me think of, Nicola, as you're bringing that up, is I do think we as clinicians sometimes set this bar for ourselves that somehow we're supposed to be expert at everything. And then we feel really, it's the imposter syndrome. We start to feel anxious when we feel like we're not expert in something. I learned this in working with veterans for many years. You should not pretend that you know more than you know, because veterans will know it in a second. You know, if you try to put on airs and pretend like you know things about military culture that you don't know, the best way to actually learn more about military culture is to be humble and ask the questions and acknowledge when I don't know. And the same goes for people from many different backgrounds. You know, so if I come into the room, therapy room, I'm using this now because oftentimes it's virtual rooms, right? But if I'm coming into the therapy room with somebody who is speaking to an area that all of a sudden I feel anxious that I don't have expertise in, that's when I need to acknowledge that and say, I really want to hear from you and your experience. Be humble and ask rather than bolting for the door and saying, I got to refer you somewhere else. Because that person, one of the things we know about referring out, I mean, we know this across the psychotherapy literature, right, and the healthcare systems literature, is when people get referred, a high percentage of people never make it to the next referral door. There's a lot of falling through the cracks right there. And we need to really acknowledge that. So while there's no way you or I as a clinician can be expert in every culture and everybody's background, I think being humble is a way of acknowledging that and wanting to learn. And to also acknowledge that sometimes people really do need a referral out. But I want to start from the place of listening to and having a transparent discussion rather than trying to be an expert or bolting for the door. I want to take that middle place.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice clarification. And for me, having worked with many, many patients, veterans, and otherwise, who had very different cultural backgrounds from myself, you know, I think I've been more consistently surprised at how willing they are to have those conversations and to engage with me and to acknowledge, like, yep, you're white. We have really different levels of experience or privilege. And yet, you know, there's also a way for us to like to come together and to talk about these things in a way that I think feels safe for them.
Right. It's the acknowledgement. Like I have privilege. I can't entirely know. Can you help me learn?
So I know that one of the projects that you're working on with Lyra Health is actually a BIPOC social worker training program.
Yes.
So I'm assuming the goal is to get more diverse clinicians into the pool. But can you share about that program?
Absolutely. This is a really exciting program. And I credit my colleagues who've worked on that. If she's out there at all, our Director for Clinically Responsive Care, Danielle Cottenham, who is a psychologist as well, has done amazing work on this. I'll do credit to Danielle. I was very lucky to come into being the director overseeing this area where one of the really fun things is the BIPOC Fellowship. It's exciting to me. So, you know, one of the things that happens, and if you look at the data, between graduating and getting licensed as a provider, there can be some impediments along the way to getting licensed. One of the things that some data suggests or supports is that individuals who are BIPOC identified have higher hurdles to cross to get there. It's interesting to take a look at social work training compared to psychology training. So psychology training has a very well-developed postdoctoral fellowship track, right, that many, many people can jump right into. You get paid, you get all the hours you need for licensure, and by the end, you should be ready to sit for your licensure exam. Social work does not have as many well-defined programs post-MSW. So from the time that you become an MSW to the time you become a licensed clinical social worker, getting those necessary hours, which takes on average of about 2 years, across the United States, if you look at different states, it takes about 2 years worth of full-time clinical experience supervised in order to get those hours. That can be hard to come by if as a new MSW, you go take a job and hope that they can give you the supervised hours and experiences. It's not necessarily baked in the cake. I think it's a testament to this that, you know, as we were starting this program, there are a number of people who had their MSWs for several years who are applying to the fellowship program because they've been out in the field, but they're having a hard time getting all their hours. There it is, right there, right? So people taking jobs, like if one of the first jobs you could get is staffing the psychiatric emergency room at a local hospital, and you always get the shifts that people don't want first, and you're getting evening shifts, weekend shifts, this is an example, you know, it may be much harder to accrue those hours for yourself. Or, you know, that there's in social work, if you take a more medical social work job, getting clinical supervision, like towards being a mental health clinician, is not necessarily, again, baked into that cake. Some folks are not finding those hours that they need. And some are. Some are doing fabulously well in that. But there are many people who are struggling with that. And so the goal of this program that we wanted to build is to give BIPOC MSWs an opportunity to engage in a 2-year fellowship that was designed to give them licensure hours, to have a whole educational curriculum developed around how to be a most excellent clinical social worker and mental health social worker, professional development series, and help with licensure. Part of our program is also going to help people with things like some money for testing materials, which are very expensive, as we all know. Anyone who's in healthcare can tell you that licensure prep materials are very expensive. Finding the opportunity to go or even the fees to get to take your testing. You know, this costs thousands of dollars, and that's, it's hard to come up with thousands of dollars when you are at the lowest income generating part of your career. Right? It's interesting how healthcare works this way. At the place at which you are making the least amount of money, you got to cough up the most to make it to the next level. There you go. There's an impediment there. It's a large part of what we're trying to do is to remove those impediments so that people are able to catapult into a career as a licensed clinical social worker. And so that's why we developed this 2-year program. We are right now, you know, recruiting for and getting ready to start our first class in September. So invite me back a year from now. We can talk about how it's all going. Hopefully it's going well.
I would love to.
And we plan to have 2 classes at a time. So we're going to start with our inaugural class, who will be year ones. Then when they become year twos, we'll have another year one class coming in. And the idea is to keep that going.
Wow. So you're going from a position where there's baked in inequity. And honestly, it sounds like those early career social workers kind of get taken advantage of. And then you're creating a system where there's baked in support and structure and helping people move over those or through those hurdles, getting that experience, getting that supervision, and then being able to move into independent practice. So why do you think it's so difficult for social work or maybe for other disciplines to recognize some of those baked in inequities or hurdles that are existing within the disciplines and training structures?
How political am I allowed to get? Can I get political for a second?
You can say whatever you want.
Well, so there's a bullet train route and there's a freight train route in America. Okay. And if you are on the bullet train route, way back when you were in a privileged enough position to be able to avail yourself of the educational opportunities, you may have had a family of means that helped you do that. And then you got to go to a really good college. Let's say that you got, I'm just going to pick, I'm not trying to beat up on Stanford, but let's say you got a chance to go to Stanford. And then when you're at Stanford, you had the opportunity to do research with a top level researcher. Maybe you got a pub, you've got a letter of recommendation. That gets you into an excellent grad school. A lot of the excellent grad schools might provide you some money to be able to make it through without taking $200,000 in loans. Or whatever the case may be. And then that catapults you into good training after that, which catapults you into a good job. That's the freight train route. And in America, I sometimes think that we say, the image is that we all bootstrap ourselves up. Okay. We all bootstrap ourselves up, and this is a meritocracy. And because you have the merit, you have the intelligence and the work ethic, you got yourself on that bullet train, and you got to where you are because of your hard work. Somebody had to build the train tracks and the train to get you there. Okay, you did not build the train tracks and the train yourself. And so some individuals are more on the freight train route, where there's a lot of stops in between, because they did not have those kinds of opportunities. And I'm not going to say that BIPOC individuals across America are all going to be facing some of those hurdles. And yet, I mean, we know that if we're going to look at the percentages, it's going to be much higher, right? Plus, there's also going to be the structural racism that can be built into the whole educational field, right? The biases in terms of how did you get selected to work in that person's lab? How did you get the opportunity to get a letter of recommendation from them? Were there biases in that? And then you got to work for free for them, because that's how a lot of that goes. Whereas one of your BIPOC schoolmates had to go work a job in order to help them afford college. And of course, it's not going to be all BIPOC individuals. There are plenty of Caucasian individuals who have to do the same thing. But I think you get where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the system has a bullet train and a freight train modality built into it. And so one of the things I'm interested in is how can we create fewer stops on the freight train route and get people onto a bullet train route or just a route where they're moving along and able to get themselves catapulted into their career.
Yeah, I really appreciate that metaphor. And one thing that I worry about is honestly like systemic collapse from not having enough clinicians being trained and on that bullet train, as you say. And, totally. You know, if we could get more people being trained so consistently and so easily and moving through that system or that process quickly and easily, it's really better for all of us. So I love the idea of figuring out how to start taking away or creating more systemic infrastructure that is supportive from people from communities of color or, you know, diverse marginalized backgrounds, because, you know, in part, some of those communities are the ones who need people who look and feel and have those same experiences the most. But I also think that our healthcare system is just richer and stronger when we have more diverse employees.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. It makes us all better. Like, how do we, you know, we work together a lot in teams over here, and teams work best with diverse experiences and points of view. And so the more mono you get, the more you fall into certain kinds of groupthink, and the more you create a bubble for yourself in terms of your team, the work you're doing, you know. And so I think that that's a really important piece of this as well, is not only is it important to have therapists out there who look like me, right, that a client can come to and say, okay, I feel like I can really connect to you, but it makes the workplace better too, because it brings in diverse perspectives and experiences, lived experiences, that are critical towards making a richer, better work product, whatever your work product may be.
So what do you think other healthcare organizations can do to start moving in that direction, either prioritizing more diversity in the team or starting to kind of create a new pipeline to get, you know, diverse or BIPOC individuals from, you know, from the ground up, from their basic educational training all the way up through the system?
I think that you have to have a workplace that is willing to first stop and assess your baseline. Where are you right now? And I think a lot of workplaces are hesitant to even go there because they're afraid of the quote unquote can of worms that they might open. And I think you have to be willing to open that can of worms, because there's important worms help the soil grow. Let me stick with my metaphor here, and we need to let the worms out so we can help the soil grow. So I think you have to start with like an assessment of where you're at, and that we have an openness to discussion and communication, and a shared commitment to make things go forward. Right. So in other words, can we hear from the individuals in our organization already about how things are going and where they think the work needs to be done? Start to work on that piece to create more belongingness and inclusiveness and psychological safety. And then making your workplace and advertising it as such, like, we are an inclusive workplace and we want you. This is my the reverse Uncle Sam. Like, we want you, like, come work for us. And building pipelines, right? So, well, you know, from an educational ethics point of view, we are not obligating any of our inaugural BIPOC fellowship class to come work for us. We sure hope that they would consider it. You know, that they would say, hey, this is a great work environment and we'd like to stay here. We want to build that pipeline so we can have more BIPOC clinicians. And certainly some of our fellows won't stick around. They'll go out and have, we hope, wonderful careers in other places. And that's great. People have their own personal goals. But we want to create that pipeline, right? And I do think that that's necessary across the health sciences, you know, is to take a look at this. I think I was hearing something, and please correct me if I'm wrong, or please excuse me if you're out there and I'm getting this wrong, but there was an analysis of I think it was orthopedics, And orthopedics had some of the lowest levels of BIPOC individuals who are coming into residencies. What can they do? And what can we do? We're not perfect by any means, but what, you know, you have to do an analysis and think about ways of creating pipelines and openings for individuals so that we can help break down some of those barriers and facilitate entry into the field or into the workplace where we are too.
So being willing to really be honest about where we're at and then make those really difficult but perhaps pretty obvious changes to create a safer pipeline. I interviewed Dr. Orlando Sanchez recently, and he was talking about how the field of psychology anyway has done a lot to bring in BIPOC individuals. However, retaining them after they start their graduate program has been really, really challenging, and they have not done so well with that. And so, like, I guess the retention just kind of percolates in my mind and like how to really create like those safe environments where people can make it in and then feel good, feel supported, and feel like they are valued for what they uniquely bring, and their own cultural background is valued. Yes. And honored, and they don't feel forced to be white or, you know, to fit in with the hierarchical structure that might not be a good fit for who they are.
Mm-hmm. When you, and if you think about like not only income distribution but wealth distribution in America, you know, some of the research that's emerging suggests that if you look at the school loan issue, you know, and this has been talked about a lot as President Biden is considering some loan forgiveness, we know that Black people are more likely to have school loans without the benefit of the degree that might make them the money, the same requisite amount of money. And part of that is if you don't stay in the field, but hey, I still have, you know, I did 1 year of my 2 year MSW program, and I've got $40,000 worth of loans, but I'm not an LCSW right now. There's a structural inequity there that I think we need to consider as a society.
So really, retaining people in the education programs becomes another, you know, equity related challenge. Yep. That we have to address from that big societal level, not just within each program itself.
Yes. And then germane to our program is the next step, which is becoming the LCSW. You know, if you stay as in the state of California, and that's our company's based in California, and our program is going to be California focused for now. So I've gotten to know a lot more about how California does this. There are a number of individuals out there who stay at what's called the associate social worker status. So they get licensed initially as an ASW. But then to become an LCSW, you have to have the 2 years of supervised experience and sit for the licensure exam and complete the state jurisprudence exam and things of that nature. There are a number of people out there who are in an underpaid position who got MSWs but did not make the LCSW because of some of these hurdles we've talked about. So there are people out there working as social workers but are not getting paid the LCSW salary that they deserve because of all the hard work that they've done. So that there's another place where people are getting underpaid, they're underemployed for their level of qualification.
So just another example of taking advantage financially of these people who are in these positions of having less power in the system.
Yes.
So my last question for you is, like, what has kept you sustainable working in, you know, big healthcare systems, working in challenging situations where there is systemic inequity? What's kept you engaged with that and helping you, like, or has helped you to, like, move forward and continue to focus your energy on making things better systemically?
Yeah, I think that for me, it's been this idea that I know that I can't fix everything. So what can I do? What can I contribute? It's a sense of contribution. Where do I have some modicum of control? And where can I make a contribution to make things a little better? So I think what we're talking about today is what nourishes me, you know, whether that be in terms of addressing structural inequities or if it's just more generally making sure that the next generation of mental health clinicians are implementing the highest level of evidence-based psychotherapy. So it's the sense of giving back, of making a contribution that maybe I played a small part in that. It's small because when people are getting trained, they have a lot of different influences. But did I make some contribution to that? That person is now going out there and being an excellent clinician and helping other people. So, because if I stop to take in too much of it, it can be pretty, of all the issues that we face, it can be a little overwhelming feeling. So, you know, being able to focus on some pieces that I can affect some change to hopefully make things better, that nourishes me.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you.
And education happens to be my thing. I mean, I really enjoy the clinical work too. And I've always enjoyed doing psychotherapy, which is nourishing for me as well. But I'm focusing a lot more on the education piece of my career right now, which is very nourishing to me.
Hmm. And I mean, I guess I'm curious, how have you found that balance, or how have you created a balance between those two things, the clinical and the educational, throughout your career?
You're assuming that I have a balance.
True. Balance.
Yeah. No. I think I've been really fortunate. I mean, the VA, it started off in my VA career by being able to carve a certain amount of time out. I didn't want to be 100% clinician. And I wanted to keep my hand in the clinical care world. And I'd like to get back to it. I'm not doing that right now. I'd like to get back to it. But I did spend about 20 years doing more clinical work than training and education. But training and education was about 30% of my career in the VA in the latter like 12 years or so of those 20. So having this percentage of time that's dedicated towards training and education has been very important to me. I really started off my career as in the research modality. That's where I was gunning for. I was gunning for the large scale grants and being like a post-traumatic stress disorder researcher. And then I realized I'm a lot more passionate about teaching and educating and training than I am about doing the research part of it. It brought me more edification. And so I found ways to carve out those pieces of time for myself. And then that led to this position I'm in now, where I've been able to move into a more systems level role, where I can create systems of education and training for a whole organization. So that's been exciting to me. But now I need to find my balance and get back to clinical work, which I intend to do, because I wanted to get some things set in place here. But I want to start seeing some of our Lyra clients as well, so I can keep my hand in that game.
Wow. Well, thank you. I know that there's been recent research that has looked at the importance of balance as defined by the clinician, and how, you know, working within their areas of strength and passion really keeps them motivated. So I love hearing how that works and has worked for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It was really a pleasure to have this conversation.
Well, thanks. And it was my pleasure to take the time. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for listening to Menders. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with a friend. And don't forget to head on over to mendinghealthsystems.com to get started creating cultural transformation for your healthcare team today. Let's create transformation magic.